This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. It is a beautiful Monday, a little humid, But happy to be here. Excited to be doing another interview. Great guest lined up for you guys today. Before we make a quick intro, we've got to start things off with our Patreon question of the day, which is, what is the best childhood vacation you ever went on?
I know mine.
Go.
Hands down. So growing up, I grew up with a single dad, and we had no money at all. And dad wanted to take me to Disney World. So he had saved up like maybe $300, $400 in cash. Didn't even put it in the bank because he was scared he would lose it if he put it in the bank. And we drove from Edmond, Oklahoma to Orlando. And he's thinking, we picked up his little brother on the way. His little brother was in college at LSU. So we picked him up on the way. And we get to Orlando. And I'm like 7 years old. I clearly remember this. And dad's thinking we'll just get a hotel room when we get there. He made no plans. He thinks you just show up and buy tickets or whatever. And this is in the early 80s, okay? So we get there. He could not afford any of the hotel rooms that were right around the park. And he was like, you know, I can only spend maybe $30, $40 on a hotel room. And they're like, well, you need to go back that way. Just go far away from the park. And so we end up backtracking like an hour outside of Orlando. We stay in a motel that was very much like the Bates Motel. Roaches creepy. All over the room. And I enjoyed killing all of the roaches. That I found that as my job. It's just to go around and stomp all of the roaches. We got a bucket of fried chicken for the whole trip.
That's a good trip.
We stuffed the chicken in a bag and went to Disney World. Well, it ended up raining and no one wanted to ride on the rides in the rain, but the rides were still going. So we rode in the rain all day, no lines, and we had the best time ever. It was my favorite trip. And my dad ended up doing really well for himself. And so the next time we went to Orlando, I was probably 20, and we flew in a private plane and stayed in the nicest hotel at Disney World. And it totally different. It was actually the extremes of different spectrums of going there financially. And I enjoyed the first time better. So, because we had to like, just enjoy it. We enjoyed every moment. I loved it so, so much. That is my absolute favorite childhood vacation.
That's awesome.
How about you, Eric?
I got to say, when I was younger and my folks also didn't have a lot of money, we would rent a beach house for 2 months over the summer in Bethany Beach, Delaware, which is like my second home. It's not too far away from where I am here, just north of DC. And we'd do it with two other families. And so it was the adults all had the bedrooms and the kids were just in, you know, in hallways or an old extra mattresses on the floor. But it was that's just that community of families and all my friends just there living together and spending a month like that, just have these incredible memories from that. And I think that's a great way to grow up.
That's awesome.
Yeah, mine too. That was a cabin on the lake. We didn't have any money or anything like that. And we stayed there for a week or two. And it's just the experience about being down there. And seen the movie Grown Ups? I watch that movie a lot because it reminds me of that trip. Because I got to get a couple friends with you. Like the family elders would come in, and their kids would come in, your cousins or whatever, and you can just sit there and sit outside, play in the water and do all that. That was the best. Yeah, for sure.
So I think really as long as you're with family and you're doing something, it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter how much money you're spending. Just being together outside of your normal element is really the best vacation. Anybody
it's really
can have
important.
Yeah, and anybody can have that. You don't have to do something fancy and book all of the fancy things. It's really just that bonding time of being outside your normal comfort zone.
Well, it's funny, everybody grows up out in the country in a cabin on a pond or a lake, they want to get to the big city. But everybody in the big city wants to make a bunch of money so they can get a cabin on the lake to relax.
Right. Well, now everybody wants to get out of the big city, especially with the last 2 years.
That's right. Everyone loves sitting around a campfire at the end of the night next to the lake telling stories with your friends. I mean, that's just like the if you could get it? What's the best moment for anybody? And they're like, the sports game. Like, well, some people, most everybody likes to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Andrew, do you have one?
Yeah, so back in the day, you could read books at school for, it was called like the 600. You can't read now.
You can't read. You're not even allowed to read anymore, man. Back in the 1900s, man, you used to be able to read in school.
But we would do this thing where it's called the 600 Minutes Club. And I think you'd read enough books and log your minutes. And then when you got the minutes, you'd get free Six Flags tickets. Mm-hmm. And back then, Astroworld existed. And so for me, you know, same kind of situation. We didn't have a lot of, you know, money. And so that was like our bigger trips, was going just into Houston to go to Astroworld. And that was the best time. But I think I can just bounce off what y'all are saying. And sometimes it's just about making time to just go and just get out, even if it's just 2 days.
Didn't you go on vacation with my family?
My best non-my family childhood vacation.
That's a great way to say that. Yeah. You should come up with a word for that.
Your family took me to Pensacola Bay.
Oh, nice.
And that was my first time on a plane, first time out of Texas, first time eating oysters. There was a lot of firsts.
I've known Andrew since he was a little kid, so.
All right.
Yeah. That was probably my most fun non-family
trip. I wasn't on that trip, but I remember you going. That
was a lot of fun. John, you got one?
Mine is actually Disney World, too. But so my parents bought a timeshare condo in Kissimmee, Florida, the year before they opened Disney World.
Oh, my gosh.
So they got it super cheap. And so we actually went to Disney World, even though we didn't have a lot of money growing up. We went quite a bit.
Because you had the place to stay.
We had a place to stay that was close.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, my favorite time, we did not take my cousin Aaron with us on this one trip. And Hurricane Aaron came in, and we ran from it. Like, we tried to still have a vacation, and we went to Pensacola, and then it hit there, and then we went somewhere in Alabama, it hit there, and then Louisiana. And we kind of just worked our way back home in increments instead of just going straight
home. But Aaron
home,
was but chasing you. He chased us the whole way,
and we took him the next year. That's awesome. It didn't happen again. Man.
That is awesome.
Great Patreon question.
If you guys haven't already, check it out, patreon.com/teamneverquit. We have exclusive access to behind-the-scenes content, some really great swag, some cool foam backgrounds. There's all kind of great stuff there. And most importantly, you can get the ability to ask your questions to the guests and have a good time participating in the show. We have got a great guest in store for you guys today. Eric is an accomplished public speaker, a security expert, the author that lectures internationally about espionage and national security, cybersecurity, fraud, corporate diligence, and defense. Excuse me. I can't even speak English.
I remember what I told you. You're supposed to break it down. You're supposed to break into the voice when you stutter like that.
Yeah, when I stutter, just the voice.
Like, just do the...
In February 2001. Yeah, there.
Immediately. That way, it's like you didn't mess up.
Just a smooth transition.
Thank you.
That's awesome. In February 2001, Eric helped capture the most notorious spy in U.S. history. Eric O'Neill, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks, guys.
I mean, you look like a Jason Bourne and a James Bond. I mean, from what I know about you and what you had to go through, that makes you very, very proficient at this job.
Yeah, I was good at it. That I don't have to be too modest about. I was I was highly trained to work undercover. My job at the FBI was to go undercover. Actually, for all the years I was in the FBI, I never came out of cover. I was tasked to surveil and investigate foreign intelligence officers. So those are your spies. Foreigners who are working here, but sometimes there were some of our own who were spying for other countries, and terrorists who are operating primarily around the DC area.
Wow. Well, let's take it back a couple notches and where'd you come from, and tell us like what.
How did you get into this? So yeah. That's the best way. The best stories are like, all right, bro.
How did you even get into the FBI?
Where did you seed from?
Yeah, it was a pretty complicated path to get into the FBI. I was born pretty much into the Navy. My father was a U.S. Navy Academy grad, class of 68. My grandfather was a gunnery officer on a destroyer out in the Pacific. I have two other uncles who were in the Navy. I mean, I come from this crazy Navy family. My two youngest brothers went to the Naval Academy. I was supposed to go. I was raised to go to the Naval Academy. That was my parents met there on the steps of the academy, and we're married there.
Okay, so you're
and
one so of those families.
I'm one of those families. Yes.
All right, the story just got better then, because it's always the one that doesn't get to go in, right? From the entire family.
Exactly, and I was.
That's a big deal. What he's talking about. That's a big deal.
All through high school, that's what I struggled for the grades. I wanted to fly. You know, this is when the first Top Gun was out, right? Right when I was in high school. So that was a big incentive, right? That's what everybody wanted to do. Go fly a Tomcat.
Hey, same thing. Tom Cruise, man, like, I think the guy just saved America with that new movie. I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it.
I saw it yesterday, and it is so good.
Thank you, Tom Cruise, right? Yeah. I heard he did the first one. I wanted to be a pilot. The F-18 models, or no, excuse me, 14s. The Tomcats. Yeah, the Tomcats, which were a badass aircraft, for those of you who don't know. There's a reason why they put them suckers in there. And I'm sorry, man. I find it fascinating that your whole family's like that. Yeah. I really do. But
did your parents get married at the cathedral?
They did.
So beautiful.
It was Old Navy. My uncle, who was my father's classmate, introduced them.
Oh my gosh! How
good
cool.
Lord! Did you have a great grandfather that had an eye patch and a corncob pipe? Because I mean,
it feels that way sometimes.
I mean, to know, as I didn't go to the academy, but I have buddies that do. But we go up there quite a bit, and when you see the history, and I asked about this too, same way at Army.
At the West Point.
West Point. I was like, hey, man, you guys got a family in here that has a kid here right now where they've been in here since y'all started?
Yeah.
And he's like, there's a couple of them. Mm-hmm. That's a thing. Yeah. Which,
I believe
no
it.
Pressure for the damn kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't screw that up. And then for the university, how are you going to kick that sucker out? But they're like, we would. That's what makes it so hard.
I believe that too.
They would.
I got in 1 year deferred. It's pretty tough to get into the academy from Maryland. Right, because everybody.
I was going to ask you, is that where you were living? You grew up in that whole area, crab cakes and football, Maryland. Right? That's what Maryland
just
does.
Just north of DC, and so I decided to go to Auburn University for a year, study aerospace engineering. I got in there because if I had great skin in the academy, you'd get in pretty much everywhere. And after a year of Auburn, I didn't want to leave. You know, I met a girl. I had a cool group of friends. Auburn, Alabama is an amazing place. I was back down to my southern roots. I'm not from here. I'm from South Carolina, Charleston.
I'm dirty south, baby. I was just up in there. Do you hear me?
Up in there.
It just comes up naturally, man. I can't help it.
It was probably one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had in my life. Is coming home and sitting down in front of my parents and telling them I've decided not to go to the Naval Academy.
Yeah, I want to hear that. Do you mind? Is it okay? I'd love to hear that story.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it was a terrible story.
Did you prep it?
My mom started crying, which made it worse.
Aww. How long did you stew on it?
But my father looked at me and he said, you know, you have to chase your dreams, whatever they might be. If the Navy's not for you, then you'll be miserable if you go there. You have to do something. And I never forgot that conversation. And even graduating from Auburn, and thinking about what I wanted to do, I felt like I had let myself down and my family down and not going to the Navy, even though I did it for, in my mind, the right reasons. And I always wanted to serve my country. And I found a way to do it. And that was by applying to virtually every civilian agency I could. So it wasn't just the FBI. I applied to the FBI, the DEA, the CIA, the NSA, Secret Service. And back then it was, you know, you would send a postcard in and they would send you back a whole
packet full of all the books material. And applications and everything. Okay, we're talking about back in the 1900s and you and I were going in. It was hard.
It's amazing how different it is now. Kids ask me, you know, I really want to get into the FBI and what do I do? And it's like you go on FedBiz.ops.
Yep,
you apply
sign
online.
Up.
Back then, you had to use this thing called a typewriter.
Bro, I remember trying to even sign up for anything. It was mysterious. I mean, you're just like, hey, man, and guys who get in there. I thought because I want to do the academies too. You know, if we're all similar, we're cut from the same cloth. There's different sides of it, right? And I remember looking at the applications and getting stuff in the mail, and it was so much material. It was like a year of school just to even try and figure out what you wanted
just to
do.
Understand it. Yeah. And back then there was no one to explain it.
No
now
one to explain
recruiters
it.
Will hold your hand.
That's when you just like, hey man, you just got to step into it.
Yep.
That was the unknown for us. And I think that was the first time when we were released from the nest. I mean, if you get a dose of it like that in the beginning, everything else kind of gets out of the way, I think.
Right. It's a good way to put it.
I'm sorry.
I applied. I heard back pretty quickly from the FBI, the DEA, and the Secret Service. You know, I never heard back from the CIA. Apparently, later I learned that they recruit you. They think you're weird if you apply.
Yeah. Okay. I've heard that. Is that true?
And because I heard decision. That. It was between the FBI and the DEA. A friend in the Secret Service said, "Don't. You know, it. you'll take a long time to do the really fun stuff. For, you know, for the first number of years, you'll just be sitting on the nephew of someone who's important.
Oh, you're talking about the Secret Service?
Secret Service, right?
Yeah. I can talk to you all day, but I love those guys, man. That's a great job.
But it does take time to work up the ranks to the really cool stuff.
They're funny about that in there.
And I just decided between the FBI and the DEA, I was going to choose whoever gave me a Quantico slot first. And it was the FBI by one day. And I've never heard someone curse as colorfully as that DEA recruiter. And he just went off, and they're always poaching our best guys, and I was handpicked you, and I can't believe this. And you know, there's another moment in my life, right, where I was looking at two extraordinarily divergent paths in life, going into the DEA, where statistically you will pull your firearm and fire it within 2 weeks of being deployed. Right out of the academy, and the FBI, which was, I knew I was going to be doing undercover investigative work, which is a little bit more slow paced and cerebral and investigating your target and learning about them and finding that one bright moment where you've caught them doing something wrong. I just couldn't decide which I wanted, but fate decided for me.
I was going to say, Haji, was a coin flip? Because those are two different lives. That's like rock star and rhythm and blues.
I mean, yeah, I was struggling. I was talking to people. I was reaching out to people I know and trust to mentor me. And at the end of the day, like I said, I just said, whoever gives me the Quantico date first, you know, because I got to start a job here. I can't just be hanging around.
Yeah. All right. So FBI, here we go.
That's right. Got into the FBI. And then I spent the next 5 years undercover.
Wait. Back it up a little bit. Wait, you skipped over a whole bunch of stuff. What's it like going in there the first day?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, you show up. Did you bring a hairdryer? Did you bring tennis shoes?
So I mean, there are things can talk about and things I can't. Right.
Sure.
You start.
And I'm talking about the feeling.
Right. The feeling was. I got to be honest. I suddenly have a badge. I'm a law enforcement. You know, I'm a trained. Now this is after Quantico, of course. I'm a trained law enforcement officer, and my job is real serious. I am going to stop spies before they steal our secrets. I'm going to stop terrorists before they kill our citizens.
How long when they handed you your badge and creds, did you sit there and look at it that night when you got to the house?
Oh, I think I sat there for a very long time.
Right? It happens, right? You just look at it.
Letting it sink in.
You're not reading. I mean, you're reading it, but it's not like a full book. When something like that happens, it's like when you make a transition from being one type of human to the other. I try to explain this to the younger ones. I'm like, hey, when you start kindergarten and when you graduate high school, you're a different human. When you start martial arts, you're a white belt to black belt. You're a completely different type of human. Same with SEAL training in the Quantico to when you get that badge. You can feel it. And all it takes is when someone acknowledges it. And those big moments like that badge, I ask a lot of the guys that. You can tell, man, you stare at that sucker. I don't know what that is. With guys, maybe just like to see something shiny. I don't know what it is, man.
I think it is only attributable to those things. And I'm two out of the three things that you just mentioned, right? Not a Navy SEAL, but I am a black belt. That you earn and you feel like you earned it, right?
Yeah.
So going through Quantico was extraordinarily difficult. People washed out. I know going through BUDS, having a brother who went through it and hearing the stories firsthand, reading your book, That's got to be one of the hardest things to do on earth. I mean, if you go to a good school and you get a black belt and you're testing with five other people and only two of you make it, you know you earned it. When you've earned something, then when you take that moment to step back, as you said, and think about it, you realize that this is really important and truly life-changing.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar Sampler Pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
That's a great way to say that. There is a huge difference from when you looking at that badge and it reminds you of everything that you had to go through it. That's why it means something to you. As opposed to if you didn't earn it and you looked at it, it would just be something you were looking at. We're not actually looking at that object. We're looking at everything that went into getting that sucker.
Right.
Right.
It took me a full year from when I applied to the FBI until I was deployed on the street after training and with that badge and credentials. That's how serious it is and how much is invested in each person who is congressionally appointed to protect the country.
Oh, rightfully so.
When your mom was crying that you were going to Auburn, is she happy now? Like, was at that moment that you
graduated?
they were very proud.
Back in the circle of trust
for my graduation, and then I got the nod from my father. All right, it's all good now.
Yeah.
And then he just immediately started working on my younger two brothers.
All right. Aww. So hey, was he an admiral? Is he like that type of old man? Where he's like, hey, good son.
No,
good job, son. Without saying it, just kind of gives you the look.
It's funny. My uncle, who introduced my parents, stayed in much longer and always laughs about your father is the biggest Johnny Navy guy in the entire world who did 2 tours, but he was a submariner. I mean, he was doing real stuff altogether. Underwater for a very long time.
Man, them dudes and bubbleheads are different.
Yeah.
And, I've been on there.
And well, he left the Navy after I was born and went to Yale. I mean, talk about an overachiever.
Oh, wow.
Goes from one of the top, I think second in his class, the Naval Academy, to one of the top in his class at Yale.
Nerd
got
alert.
His law degree and worked at the same law firm for his entire career.
That's amazing.
Oh, man. That's like one of those
true America.
You know what I'm talking about? Like when you hear a guy who went to the academy and then after tours and being a submariner, he went to Yale and then,
exactly.
And then he
but
was
you
a
look
lawyer.
At his class.
Of course
you look
he
at
was.
His graduating class from the Naval Academy, class of 68. It's like one of the most star-studded Naval Academy classes in history. I think there are more like admirals, astronauts.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing. I didn't know that. But when you go to some of the reunions, you're sitting around hearing them talk, they'll say that. And it's true. Like some of those classes that come out of there, every one of them guys does something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. That was his class. And he loves to remind people of it. But my father's amazing. He was always an incredible mentor.
Yeah.
And also, I think what's real support important, too, is he was supportive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's always had the theory, you know, in life is that you have to do something that you love. If you're not doing something you love, then you're wasting your time.
Yeah.
Because then it's just work.
Right. So I'm sure he had his ring on all the time. He'd smack you with that sucker.
That ring never goes away.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've graduated. What happens next? Were you married at that point or?
No, I wasn't. I was single when I graduated the FBI Academy. I was living in a group house in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, what I could afford on Adams Morgan. And and that's where I met my wife in my 20s. She is German. If you read my book or seen the movie, she actually is German, came over from Germany for a 1-year professional exchange. Our congresses and their Bundestag, which is their parliament, they exchange 50 students who are the top enterprising future business prospects so that they'll learn the culture and they'll go back to their country and promote trade between Germany and America. They're not supposed to get married.
Mm.
But we met and fell in love. And I proposed to her within a year because I knew she was leaving and I wanted her to get away. Aww. And then we did spend a year apart and then got married. And it was when during all the time we were dating and our, you know, the beginning of when we got married, I was working for the FBI and couldn't tell her what I did.
Oh, wow. What did she think that you did?
You know, when we were dating, what I would tell most people is that I work for the Justice Department. And when they asked, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a geopolitical analyst. And that was just the death knell for the rest of the
nobody wants to hear that conversation.
Right. Nobody cares. And I realized at one point, you know, this is not helping me get dates.
Yeah.
Well, there's that too.
And the FBI had trained me to lie. So then I would go out and I would tell people, you know, I'm a private investigator. I'm a doctor. You know, I'm an archaeologist. I just make stuff up.
Yeah. So the best when you're going through your cover stories is that. Like, you don't want to be say something that's too complex because no one wants to talk to you. But then if it's too
interesting,
easy,
then everybody's going to ask a million questions.
So we were like, going out, we would always say, because it was usually a bunch of us. So we had to go with the team route. But if you're ever by yourself, you'd be like, man, you know, I'm a prison barber. Or a rodeo clown or something where our face had to be covered and they would just end the conversation right there. But
yeah, I liked archaeologist.
That's a good one.
Because, you know, I knew enough engineering to fudge it.
Right.
And no one really knows what archaeologist does other than they watch the Indiana Jones movies and they think that's what it is. And be like, no, it's really very slow paced and a lot of very careful, you know, excavation work, and you just make it up as you go along.
And I work in a library. The only one librarian left. I work in that. It's true. I mean, you got to put some effort into your story.
Yeah.
That's right. But we learned how to build a cover. It's called a legend.
Yeah. It gets better with age, too, because you find out what works. Hard part is when you got a cover identity and you try to throw it out there and you run into somebody who's really good at it. And you're like, oh. But like you said, geologist, man, you can go any way with that.
Or archaeologist.
I mean, archaeologist, right. Yeah, excuse me.
Or you're pretending you're something, and then you're pretending you're an archaeologist, and then you run into a geologist. Yeah, and you're like, oh, really? So what do you think of this? It's like, hey, let's just get another beer.
Yeah, I need another beer, man. What's you talking about work for?
That's right? Like that movie, There's Something About Mary.
Yeah, just like that.
The guy's lying. He says he's an architect, and he runs into like the most famous architect.
How long? But you know, when you're dating someone, they start figuring things out because, you know, I'm getting up in the morning and grabbing two huge duffel bags full of crazy gear, you know, I'm running down to a car that's been modified that no one else is ever allowed to ride in.
Yeah.
And leaving to go God knows where. And I mean, sometimes I didn't know when I'd be back. I was trailing one target once in Virginia, and I had to call and say, hey, I'm not going to be home tonight. Like, why? I'm in Miami. Yeah. What are you doing in Miami? Oh, I can't really tell you, but we'll be back later.
Well, I had a buddy who's a trooper for sticking through that. And
I had a buddy who would keep a Waffle House uniform in there, and he would show up wearing that thing because no one wants to.
Right, that is absolutely
you know what
true.
I mean, wake up in the morning, put that with that. Hey, wake up. I got to get to work. I got to cover a shift.
Oh, the morning after.
Yeah.
Well, Juliana used to say, you know, a lot of people complain that their husbands come home or their, you know, significant others come home and all they do is talk about work. But Eric never talks about work.
Yeah.
So we get to talk about other things. So she had a very good way of looking at it.
That's awesome. She sounds like a trooper.
Yeah.
And at some point she learned that I was in the FBI.
Sure.
And I'm pretty sure it's not supposed to do this. I shouldn't say this, but this one time that I got stopped by a cop and, you know, I said, oh, let me get my license out of this black case right here, which are my credentials. And that was sort of the code for, hey, I'm also a cop. And how about a little bit of professional courtesy?
Grace.
And she's like, what is that? And I was like, oh, okay.
You know, because you got that grin on your face like, hey.
It's like, how did you not get a ticket?
Yeah. I need some help here. Guy code. Come on.
It's a friend of dad's.
Yeah.
Yeah. We said friend of dad's.
Yeah, exactly.
I've known that guy my whole life.
I've known him forever. He knows me. Yeah.
He knows me.
How long were you in the FBI before you were assigned to the Information Assurance Division?
So it was my fifth year in the FBI. It was my last year there. So I was in the FBI 5 years, which doesn't sound like a lot of time after the fact, but it is a very long time to be undercover. The burnout rate was about 2 years for what I did.
Wow.
5 years is a long time. When we get in, man, it's a stretch, it's an assignment.
Your brain to keep it up with all the lies and like
it's exhausting.
That straight, that's got to be so hard mentally.
I mean, yeah, because especially if you stay in for a long time, because you could run into somebody that you ran into the first year down on year eight and be like, "Hey, I thought you were."
So, did you before the kind of famous case that we're going to get into? Before that, did you have any interesting cases that you can talk about?
I had many cases, most of which I can't talk about. It's typically when there's been a big arrest. I mean, my first case was the Earl Pitts case. That was the United States spy, and he had spied for Russia back in the Cold War, and we caught him early on in my FBI career. I can tell you there was one case I can talk about, which was the before Hansen, the only spy that I ever spoke to. And he was an American who had worked for the NSA and Department of the Army back once again during the Cold War. We were catching all these Cold War spies that the former KGB guys had started giving up as they wanted to defect, you know, in the 90s.
Yeah.
When I started in the FBI, and we'd enticed him back by false flagging him, which means that someone pretends they're a Russian, right? And saying, "Hey, we want to reconnect with you and bring you back so that we can have a discussion. We don't think it's safe to do it where he was living in Germany." And so they brought him back to the U.S. And our job, right? My team, our job was just to identify him. No one had seen him for 20 years. Identify him off the airplane. We knew what airplane he was on, right? And take him to his hotel where we were going to make the arrest. You don't want to do arrests in public places because you just never know how someone's going to react. And we felt we could isolate him there. And for whatever reason, I must have pissed off my team leader. I was all the way at ground transportation. Right, which is like the last person in the entire line of surveillance.
Probably nothing. Team leaders are always pissed off about something.
Oh, yeah. Team leaders always get mad at you about something. And who knows? I might have mouthed off, or I didn't listen, or I chased after a target when I wasn't supposed to. Who knows? Yeah. But the guys who were at the gate, because this is back before 9/11, so you could be standing at the gate. I mean, it's amazing. I talk to crowds, especially students, and they have no concept of a time in the past when you used to go park and then walk with your loved one, your friend, all the way to the gate and then watch them scan their ticket and get on the plane.
Yep.
Yes.
You know, that's a foregone error because big crises change everything. Yeah. And so we were there and missed them. And people start spinning, right? You hear the team in your earpiece going nuts. Yeah. You know, like, did he get past you? Did he not get off? Is he still on the plane? Is someone going to walk on the plane? Did you check the bathrooms? You know, all right, let's look for him and you know, luggage claim. Did anybody see him down there? Nobody saw him. And I'm just listening to all this and thinking, God, I can't imagine how everybody missed this dude. Maybe he wasn't on the plane. So you call to the agents who were in Germany. Yeah, he got on the plane. He was definitely there. Until I'm just listening. And then I hear a voice, and thankfully not my right ear where my earpiece was, but my left. "No, excuse me, sir. Do you know how to get to the Hertz Gold bus?" And I just kind of looked over, and you learn to be super nonchalant and in control of your expressions when you work undercover.
Yeah.
Nothing ever surprises you. You just completely compress that excitable, you know, immediate action, right? Because there he was standing there. And it was clear to me that was him, right? This sort of faint European accent to this old American accent, same guy, but just aged 20 years. And what really cued it in for me is he had the same laptop bag that we had seen in a picture in the past, because you memorize all the information you can.
Yeah.
I said, "There he is." And
dude walked up on you?
And I said, "Of course I do. That's sir. Awesome. You know, in fact, I'm heading there too. So why don't you just come with me?"
Matter of fact.
yeah, let's go. Get on. And so we both got on the bus. He headed toward the back. I said, "See you later." And I sat in the front, and then I just started clicking my mic. And you've been in special ops, but you know, when you can't talk,
bro,
you're near your target, you just start clicking.
Oh man. Right? Those are the greatest moments and the hardest moments at the same time. Yeah. You're like,
yeah.
Did you
the
do
team
that?
Leader in, yeah, and I hear my team leader, a guy named Waldo, that everybody had code names. And he says, "Wait, everybody stop. I hear clicking." And then he starts calling names, right? All the code names until he gets to me. And then, you know, click, click. And I go, "Okay, Werewolf must have him." And I couldn't really say anything, but we had to wait. And as soon as we got off the bus, I moved out of his earshot. And then I got on the comms, and I said, "Yeah, I've got him. We're at the Hertz parking. He's going to get a car right now. You know, move the team over here, and I need a pickup because I'm burned." So I got to go home early that day.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. How cool is that? That's such an adrenaline rush when you.
Yeah. What was that like coming home from that?
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
So cool.
You know, you love the wins, right?
Yeah.
You love the wins that you can really talk about, because that was a great case that, you know, it took a while before I finally put it in my book and the FBI said I could talk about it, but you get that high of, okay, I did my job today.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
That's so cool. So 5 years, that was your first bust, and then 5 years go by and you get tasked with what ends up becoming an infamous case. Can you tell us about that?
So the Robert Hansen investigation was a horrible problem for the FBI. First of all, the FBI had spent years going after the wrong guy. So it was very embarrassing. The agents in charge of the case had become convinced that this guy named Brian Kelly, who was a CIA case officer, was the spy they were after. And Brian Kelly was sort of the victim of circumstance. He lived near where Hansen lived. He jogged on this jogging route that incorporated just by bad chance, right, happenstance, a signal site and a drop site that Hansen had been using. And he knew he had worked this past case where we're trying to catch a spy called Felix Bloch that had gone completely wrong. And Felix Bloch was a U.S. spy who had spied for Russia, who we were going to arrest in Paris, France. And at the last minute, he got a call from his Russian intelligence officer in his hotel room saying, run. And he never showed up and we never made the arrest. But the only way that he could have known that he could have gotten that call as if there was a mole, a high place mole in the intelligence community. And we'd known that the intelligence community, and I'm not just talking the FBI, I'm talking the entire intelligence community, the entire intelligence apparatus of the United States had been compromised since the early 80s. In between 1984 and 85, sort of the middle between those 2 years, we call the year of the spy.
Yeah.
The United States lost every single asset in Russia. So all of our spies, all of the generals and the high cabinet members and government personnel who were our spies working for us, trying to make the world a better place. They didn't believe in communism, were rounded up and executed or imprisoned and given hard labor. So we knew that someone who knew their identities had given them up. And so we went on this 22-year, and when I say we, I mean the FBI, you know, obviously this predates my time in the FBI, manhunt for a spy that was codenamed Gray Suit. And it's the most legendary manhunt that in history that probably not a lot of people know about, going after the biggest spy in U.S. history, who we only knew as Gray Suit, didn't even know what agency this person was in, didn't know whether it was a man or a woman, right? Knew very little other than there's a mole and we've just randomly assigned two words and those words are Gray Suit.
And you only
so
know
each
that.
Time you went after someone, this is how it works in intelligence. Each time you go after somebody who might be the target you're after, you give them a derivative code name. So Brian Kelly was Gray Deceiver. Robert Hansen was Gray Day. And after going after Kelly for quite some time and feeling frustrated that we weren't learning anything, that it didn't look like this was the spy, the FBI and the CIA put together a joint task force to go recruit somebody over in Russia who could give us some definitive information, thinking it might point to Kelly. And so they learned about it. Someone, this business guy in Russia, he had made a ton of money after being a top KGB officer, was looking to sell some secrets. And so we bought them for millions of dollars and guaranteed school of his choice for his kids. And
so that kind of stuff really happens.
This was in the year 2000, right? Still happens. So this guy had been a KGB intelligence officer who, when the Soviet Union collapsed and was reformed into the Russian Federation, they disbanded the KGB and reformed it into two bureaus, the SVR, which is like the spies, and the FSB, which are the state police. And these KGB guys were out of work. And so they did what they were trained to do. They stole secrets. And back then, in the 80s, when everything fell apart, they would sell the secrets. This guy didn't. And he kept just a slim file of information. He sold that for somewhere around $14 million and witness protection. It disappeared into the US. And it was like the worst game of Clue, right? You know, you open the envelope and it's Colonel Mustard in the library with the wrench.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of letters, a cassette tape, and a trash bag. And with those three things, you need to build your case against the most legendary spy in U.S. history.
Say what? Trash bag? A what?
Letters.
Cassette tape and letters. So these were letters that Hansen had written throughout his career to the Russians in his dead drops. You know, when he would take secrets out of FBI and wrap them in trash bags and put them under a bridge in Folkestone Park in Vienna, Virginia. And then the Russian intelligence officer, after maybe 8 hours of what we call an SDR, a surveillance detection run, make sure he didn't have, FBI ghosts like me following him just randomly out of the Russian embassy, would then go pick up the drop. And he would wrap it in trash bags and put a letter in each one to the Russians. And so they had them and sent them back, but they were signed Ramon Garcia. They didn't really help, right? That was his code name that he used for himself.
And where did he come up with that?
We think that he thought it was kind of a sexy name, Ramon Garcia, right? This is the way he thought. Hansen was this big, goofy James Bond fan.
Yeah.
And so he needed his, cool Bond name. Also, they think that the analysts think that Garcia has the letter CIA in them.
Yeah.
And so perhaps he was trying to send a signal to the Russians that he was in the CIA, which would throw off any of our spies who were then sending intelligence that we're getting information from a Ramon Garcia, who we think might be in the CIA.
I tell you what, that's
right?
Pretty deep. If that was the case, that was deep. It wasn't, and y'all came up with that? That's real deep.
That's how my head
works. Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm talking about?
Like, that is totally your brain.
Yeah, well, I know. That's how
I think. It makes us sound smart, right?
Well,
so there you go.
Man, you know what? Somebody who knows how to work puzzles can see that.
Yeah.
Yes. And then look, we can run fingerprints. The Russians couldn't. And when they ran the prints on the trash bag, that was one of Hansen's greatest mistakes. One of his prints was on it, a partial fingerprint. So a partial match. A lawyer is going to talk a court out of that, but it was another clue. And then finally,
yeah, because it wasn't that wasn't the point team. Right to bag him, that's probably cliche, right? That was just an opening.
Yes. This is how we're getting we're learning that this might be the guy.
Yeah.
But finally we played the cassette tape, and it was the one time that Hansen, his other big mistake, he had called the Russian embassy or the consulate, I'm sorry, to say, where is my money? So he loaded a dead drop, and they're supposed to pick up his dead drop and then leave him 50 grand in cash under a pallet somewhere, right? So there was an auditorium out in the woods, not too far away from Folkestone Park, where the Russians would leave his dead drop of cash. And he went out and looked for it and couldn't find it. And so got pissed off and called them and said, this is Ramon Garcia. I want to talk to so-and-so. Where's my money? And, they were very flustered. And of course, they're Russian, so they immediately hit record. I mean, they're really good at spying.
Yeah.
And record everything. And said, well, did you look at the northeast corner of the pallet? And he's like, I'll have to get back to you. He'd gone out at night and gone to the wrong corner of the pallet. I mean, he'd left that 50,000 just sitting there.
So
anybody who comes to the Washington, D.C., you know, any of your guests or anyone listening to this podcast, when you're walking around our amazing parks and historic monuments and whatever, look under benches, lift white rocks, look in hollow trees. You might find cash or secrets.
We're doing that.
Because this is still the spy capital of the world.
All right. So hold on. Let's pause this for a second. Right. Let's start writing this down. Okay. So we're just going to write up some random maps, right, that have the best benches and knot holes. And
We
geocache.
Spies still do this.
Yeah. We like to geocache.
Well, here's the deal. It's like you could thwart a spy operation by planting some money in a different tree.
Throw them off.
Yeah, we're going with that.
Yeah. Bag of Monopoly dollars.
Most people don't think about that because DC is so beautiful. You're looking, when you look at what it is as opposed to looking inside of it, I mean, the whole place is a maze and a puzzle.
That's absolutely true. Everybody who's anybody is here and every country is represented and they're all spying on us and they're all spying on each other.
Right. Isn't that great?
So cool.
So we had enough to know it was probably Hansen. And the problem was that this is December of 2000, and he's about to retire from the FBI with his 25-year gold watch in April. So how do you run an investigation and catch a spy in a few short months? And so what the FBI did is they gave him his dream job. What made Hansen such a successful spy is that he wasn't just the most damaging spy in U.S. history. He was our first cyber spy. He was a hacker. He was a guy who, for his entire career, for fun, would learn and teach himself how to break into computer systems. And that's what he was doing in the FBI and on task forces to other agencies. He was stealing information through computer systems that were never really built to defend.
And his primary job was what in the FBI?
He was the top Soviet analyst. So he was a supervisory special agent, and his job was to analyze the Soviets and then the Russians.
Brilliant.
And determine who the spies were.
So he's looking for himself. He was
at one point tasked to catch himself.
But he's American, right?
He's American. Yep.
American born. That
can make that up.
How did he get his connection to Russia? Like, in order to work.
Yeah. I mean, like, who recruited that sucker? Did he go looking?
Well, he was. So we don't know. No one knows why he spied, right? Not definitively, because he's refused to ever answer that question.
Wow.
But I got a pretty good idea because I spent 8 hours a day with him day after day after day, sitting in a secure office with no windows, forced to talk to each other, which is what they wanted me to do so I could learn about him and then figure out how to catch him. So I got a pretty good idea why he spied. He volunteered his services. So he was never recruited. He was what's called a walk-in, although he didn't walk in. He mailed a letter to the Russian consulate saying that I want to spy for you. Here are my bona fides. And he gave up two of our top spies in Russia, one who was flown back to Moscow and executed, and the other who was sentenced to hard labor. Just as his first, didn't even get any money for it, just to prove to them that he had access. I think he spied because he was angry. The FBI had not given him the role he wanted. He had joined the FBI to be James Bond, and he was made an analyst. Now, analysts are the bread and butter of counterintelligence. Without analysts, people who do field ops like me, we waste our time. We're chasing after the wrong targets. We're chasing no targets. We don't know who to go after. And the analysts really are the cream of the crop in figuring out how to catch spies. But he wanted to be in the field. He wanted to be doing field ops. He wanted to be chasing people down, you know, shooting people with his gun, that kind of stuff.
Well, good Lord, the two guys he burned, did he know them? They take his spot? I mean, that sounds kind of personal.
No, he didn't know them, but he knew that they could have potentially, because they were working directly with the FBI, given him up. And so he removed them from the equation.
My gosh. It's pretty ruthless. That is super ruthless.
Yep. And so he was disgruntled because he didn't get the job he wanted. He also was having a lot of kids. He was living in New York City at that point, just right outside of New York City, but at the New York field office. The cost of living is incredibly high there. And instead of, you know, borrowing or asking for help or downsizing a little, he decided to spy to make the money that he needed to support himself and his family and his kids. And that's how he supplemented his income.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Well, that's what kept it going. You can understand how things get... We've had some guests on, they get into something where it's like, hey man, one thing got you in it, but then there are good things that perpetuate it. Mm-hmm. Family and
exactly, you know, but there was a point where he rose up the ranks and made enough money that he didn't have to continue doing this.
Yeah
and he could have made better life decisions and not had to do this. And I think at that point he truly felt that I don't want to give it up, because he was the best spy. I mean, the most damaging, notorious best spy in U.S. history. I mean, you could talk about Andrew, Aldrich Ames, or maybe the Walker or any of them, but nobody did the damage that he did. And he knew it. I mean, he knew, and he had gotten away with it for, at that point, 22 years.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing. He knew that at some point, if he did get caught, he would go down in history as the person that he became. But I don't think he ever thought he was going to get caught. And I think that he felt, this is what makes me the best. You know, he's like the Michael Jordan of the spy world. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's hard to give up.
Yeah. It's a
no matter
power
what
trip.
It is that you do so great.
Becomes power.
Yeah.
What was it like having to earn his trust and become his, you know, not his buddy, but essentially you had to build.
Yeah.
That.
How was that meet up?
Yeah.
It was next to impossible. It was incredibly difficult. I was set up to fail because he's been banished at the point that they asked that we built the investigation. He had been banished to the State Department because he really had problems relating to other people. A woman who worked for him had challenged him, and she didn't back down, and he grabbed her and threw her to the floor.
My
right?
gosh.
And you can't get fired from government. You just can't. It's amazing what you can do and not get fired from government. And he was just sort of sent to the State Department as a liaison to ride out his career. He never got performance reviews. Nobody checked up on him. They continued to give him his very high clearance FBI access to our database. Like, nobody was thinking, what if this guy's a spy, right? Just never occurred to the FBI for some reason that one of our own might be the one who sold out. We always thought it was in the CIA, right? And then at the twilight of his career, right as he's about to retire, the FBI higher-ups come to him and say, we're going to promote you to executive service. We're going to put you in charge of a brand new section at the FBI that we're calling the Information Assurance Section. And the Information Assurance Section is going to be in charge of identifying all of the problems in computer systems in the FBI and fixing them and making us safe from both inside and outside attacks. So, I mean, that's 2000. Today, you know what we call that? Cybersecurity.
Yeah.
The FBI put him in charge of building cybersecurity for the FBI, which is a little bit nuts if you think about it, but also real brave because they gave him his dream job, something he wouldn't say no to, knowing that not only were they giving him an incredible position at the FBI, one he'd always wanted, they're also giving him access to everything.
Yeah.
And he must have been thinking, I can keep this going for years. And so he was going to be allowed to defer his retirement while also maintaining his pension, be put in charge of a really important position under one of the top assistant directors in the FBI. And they were going to give him a staff member. They were going to try that again. And he was going to get to build cybersecurity for the FBI. And that then the FBI had another problem. They're looking around and figuring, who are we going to stick in the office with him? Because this person not only has to know how to hunt a spy, but to turn on a computer. And that was a little difficult in the FBI. We were way behind the curve in computerization. But I was always sort of a, much like Hansen, ironically, a bit of a hacker in the 80s, just fascinated by computer systems, you know, breaking security, not because I wanted to steal anything, just I wanted to understand how to make it stronger. And so I had written programs for the FBI, I had written databases, I had wrote a target tracking algorithm myself that would use target locations over time to try to predict where the Russians would be in the future. And we were catching guys using it. So that got me a little notoriety in the FBI.
That pretty quick, man. Yeah. Among your list of accolades, that's pretty brilliant strategy-wise.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, of course it is, but we should have been doing that forever instead of having analysts paper around on a table, right?
Man, well, as we try, yes, you're absolutely right.
I mean, it drove me nuts because
a little hard on ourselves too, man, because, you know, you're only as strong as that last one. You got to move them one's up front, one behind. I get what you're saying, man.
But at the same time, I was in law school while this case was going on, going over to GW and doing all my legal research on Westlaw and Lexis, which are these incredible databases. I'm thinking I can look up any case in history and whether anything in that case has been changed in seconds. But the FBI can't figure out where a Russian is going to be 2 weeks from now based on where he's been his entire career.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I also had to be able to get to night school. So I said, I'm going to work on this program during days when I'm supposed to do night shifts. And you let me out of the night shifts. And that was sort of the quid pro quo there.
Bro, I tell you what, this is what you need. That piece right there is what you should deliver to Dad because you didn't go to the academy. So yeah. You know.
Oh, he knows it all. Yeah,
I know you're pretty pissed about the academy thing.
My mother passed away in 2011, but she was very proud of my father. I think my mother still holds the record for the most times to ever watch the movie Breach.
She did.
It was just like on repeat in our living room.
Dude, moms are timeless, man. They love unconditionally.
So when the FBI was putting him in this new role, did they know that this was possibly the spy? Were they creating this position to catch him?
So we felt that there was enough actionable intelligence to believe that this was the spy we were after, but you still have to prove it. And I was able to do that pretty early on in the case. This was after I had started doubting myself and my ability to do this and whether this guy even was the spy we were after sometime into the case. And I remember, I guess, talking about the reason for this broadcast, that never quit moment is there was a moment in this case where I did want to quit. And in fact, I went to the special agent who was my handler, who was in charge of tasking me and making sure that I stayed, you know, on the bright and narrow in the case. And I went to her, her name's Kate Alleman. And I said, I don't think I'm successful here. It's also really destroying my personal life, you know, because I'm telling so many lies to my wife right now and friends and family. I'm having trouble keeping them straight. At the same time, I'm trying to, you know, do well in law school. I got one C the entire time I was in law school. Everything else was an A. And I still blame Robert Hansen for that C. It was in corporations, and I ended up becoming a transactional lawyer, which is corporate law. So,
hey, son of a bitch, you got me kicked down to another pay grade. Yeah. I'm really not feeling sorry for you about one C, though.
I know. But still, I mean, damn.
If that's what you're looking for, I can give you some, like, bro. I mean,
yeah,
I was mad. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I can see that.
I was struggling and I wasn't sleeping. And she told me, look, I hate to tell you this, but you just really don't have a choice because there's no way we can pull you out right now. We pull you out, this entire investigation is done. He's starting to trust you and you just got to stick with it. And that's where she told me things that I didn't know, right? About what Hansen had done, what they were learning, what they believed that spy had done, the people that he had caused to be killed, that, you know, were on the blood on his hands. And that made me angry. And at the same time, I also talked to my dad. I couldn't tell him what I was doing, but, you know, I could tell him that, you know, I'm having trouble with this job. And he was like, well, you got to stick through those things that you agree to do. You got to stick with it. You can't in the middle of something leave, right? And he was right. And so I renewed my will to win this job, not just to conduct the investigation, but to win. And where things really changed for me was when I had a conversation with Hansen about Felix Bloch. Now, remember, I got back to this. Everything I say is supposed to make sense later, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I'm writing, that's the way we do this. So remember, Felix Bloch was the spy that got away in Paris that made the FBI think the CIA guy, Brian Kelly, was Gray Suit, the legendary spy. And the FBI was totally wrong. It turns out that Robert Hansen had mined information about the case and then given it up to the Russians, who then warned Felix Bloch. So it was Hansen who had done that. And there was no way he could have known about that case. And he was bragging about it, that he had known all of it. And the FBI was so stupid. And Felix Bloch got away because the FBI didn't act when they should have acted. And when I brought it to the analyst, they said, it's him. There's no way he could have known this unless he was the person who gave it up. And that just renewed my sense of justice, that this is important. This is the spy and I'm going to catch him. And I moved from let's find information to determine whether this is the guy we're after to, all right, it's crank it up to 11, full forward. And, we're going to catch this guy no matter what it takes.
Were you ever worried about him finding out who you were?
He knew who I was. So that was the other scary thing about this case. I was not given a legend. We were doing this in FBI headquarters. And so he knew exactly who I was and who I'd done. So when I say that it was stacked against me, what I mean is he's given his dream job. He's being put in charge of cybersecurity for the FBI. He's being asked not to retire and his retirement deferred. He's given someone to work with. And he's got to be thinking, are they on to me?
Right.
Because they treated me like crap for the last 2 years. And now suddenly they're giving me everything.
Right.
And he only had one point of attack. And that was me. So his job was to clean himself by getting me to screw up. My job was to make him feel like, no, this was a real position. The FBI really needed you to build cybersecurity for them by not screwing up. And wow, for a good part of this investigation, that was the best I could do, just not screw up. And I realized at some point that I'm never getting out of this if I don't rise above myself and start actively forcing him to screw up. And so I had to turn the tables on the master spy. And I did that by learning from him, seeing what he was doing to me and then turning it around.
What was the moment, like the breaking moment for the people that haven't seen the movie or read your book yet? Like, what was that moment that you're like, okay, this is him, go in, move forward?
Yeah, it was a moment I was sitting with Kate Alleman, and this was the special agent who was in charge of making sure I didn't screw up, right? And I had stolen during a search from him a data card. And when we downloaded the data card. This is earlier on, right? The next came the Palm Pilot. That's how we caught, yeah, we caught him. But this data card had some letters on it, letters written by Ramon Garcia. And she let me read them. And I remember reading those things and just getting angry, thinking that this is the guy that I have spent my career trying to catch. And finally, here we are locked in a room together and he's not getting away.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. That's such a rush too.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying, this is a problem I have a lot. Like retelling something, I was like, hey, the moment is different. Man, like when you're standing in that sucker and you could, the intensity, how you walk in there, are you playing that in your head?
Oh yeah, you feel like your entire body just got hooked up to a power line.
Oh yeah.
You're vibrating with it. You feel it in your past, present, and future.
Did he ever show signs that he was onto you?
He would try to trap me. He would do things to throw me off. He would say things to throw me off. Like one of our first conversations, he told me about what he called Hansen's Law. And he said, Hansen's Law is that the spy is in the worst possible place. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Like, you're the spy, right? You know, like, what are you trying to do here? And what he was trying to do was mess with my head. Mm-hmm. And that was his MO. And he said, and it's a very eloquent law, really, if you're in counterintelligence. He said, the spy is in the worst possible place. He's that person who has access to the information that is going to do the most damage, and the knowledge and the wherewithal to get that information to those who are going to pay him the most for it. And that, Eric, is what we are here in the FBI to catch. And I was thinking in my mind, that's you, man. You're just giving me the roadmap, and that's who I need to catch because you are that person. But there were things like that. I remember, you know, out of the blue, he said, we're going to church. Let's go. I'm like, what? It was in the middle of a week. It was like Wednesday over lunch. He's like, I go to a church at lunch. Let's go. We're going. And he knew I was Catholic because he knew everything about me. I was Eric O'Neill, right? They couldn't give me a legend because, they give me a name, John Smith, and I'm walking down the hall with them and someone says, hey, Eric, what's up? You know, that I knew from a different case. We're working in FBI headquarters. So I had to be myself. So he knew not only my name, but my wife's name. He had my social security number because he was my supervisor, you know, my address. He knew my parents' names, all of it.
Yeah. So there wasn't even a paper trail on you doing your job.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's doing my performance review, for God's sake.
So y'all go to church together midday.
And I got to tell you, because I am Catholic, which was part of the reason I was selected. He really was watching me, right? And I'm thinking, look, I got this, right? I know how to go to church. Yeah. Like, I'm not making this up. I don't have to make believe. Like, but I was sweating a little when we were saying the Our Father. I was thinking, like, man, I better not, you know, just be nervous and make a mistake here. Right. But that, after
why are you
that,
sweating, man? Well, I'm always like this when we're talking like, to Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. After that, though,
don't you sweat?
Marcus and I are Catholic too. So I'm thinking you're in there and you're walking up to receive the host. Are you like sweating thinking I'm lying in church? Or are you just thinking it's your job?
You know what I was thinking? I was thinking this guy shouldn't be in here. God wants me to do this.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
100%. And that's that warrior mentality right there. I learned a lot about the fact that he was an Opus Dei. He started to recruit me into Opus Dei.
What is that?
He started
having some very significant conversations about Catholicism and marriage. He was pretty pissed off that my wife and I had been married for 3 months and she wasn't pregnant yet. But once you get into conversations like that, I knew I gained his trust.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. That's so crazy.
Did you get to be a part of the actual arrest of him, the final kind of final straw, if you will?
I didn't. I was the guy who found the information that led to that arrest, but I was not there on the arrest day because he did not know, as he was arrested and then later that I was the person who found the information.
Wow.
And they weren't going to tell me for a while. They weren't going to tell him because at the end of the day, I would have had to testify to most of the evidence we found because I found it. And then he would have known on the stand.
Oh my gosh. That is so crazy. So did,
that's a great story, man.
It really is a great story. And after this, I want everybody to watch the movie and
check out the book.
Yeah. But yeah. the, uh, Did his wife know, like, when all of it came out, did his wife and kids know what he was doing?
So there is some difference of opinion on whether his wife knew or not, right? At one point, she did find some money that he had hidden and actually told him that he needed to turn himself in or asked him about it. And he went to his priest and the priest said, look, you need to donate that to charity and never do it again. He downplayed it. You know, I did something wrong, but it's not really terrible. No one got hurt. His brother-in-law, who was also in the FBI, had found out about this from his wife and had tried to turn him in at one point, but he was ignored. I mean, just the stars were aligned for Hansen. I'm not sure Bonnie really knew, or if she did knew, she didn't understand, let's put it that way, the complexity of what was going on. I mean, when Hansen was arrested, one of the things he said was, what is Bonnie going to do? She doesn't even know how to balance a checkbook. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think they had their roles in the family. And he was the one in charge of the money. He was the moneymaker and their finances. And that was that. She was in charge of their like seven kids. I don't think any of his children knew at all. I think they were very shocked by it. And, but at the end of the day, the FBI investigated her and decided that she wasn't culpable. So she was never arrested. The family was allowed to keep his pension in return for his plea agreement. And the family was not punished. He was.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's how it should be.
You
know, honestly,
there's a way to say they're punished because their father went to jail. But yeah. I mean, he was a pretty bad guy.
Right. That's insane. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, all it took to take Hansen down at the end of the day was a Palm Pilot, believe it or not.
Dang. Ramon Garcia. That is so crazy. So after that, you decided to retire. You're like, okay, I did my job.
Well, I went back to the street, you know, after working undercover in this direct face-to-face investigation, which we call an elicitation investigation, where, I mean, at the end of the day, the way we caught him is I was able to steal his Palm Pilot from his bag. We tricked him into getting him out of the office. I had an assistant director come in and asked him to go down and shoot in the basement shooting range of FBI headquarters. It's down in the sub-basement. And while he was down there, I lifted his Palm Pilot, which is, I've got one right here. This is one that was used in the movie. It's what's called a PDA, right? Yeah. Personal Data Assistant. Like anyone under 40 will have no clue what that is, but it had a screen, but you used a plastic stylus to tap things in. Well, he kept a lot of information on his Palm Pilot, and including some of his letters and dates he would do dead drops and those kind of things. So I stole it, got it down to a tech team that was three floors down, and they started copying it. I got the Palm Pilot, a data card, and a floppy disk out of his bag, and his bag had four pockets. They were all the same. And as they're copying it, I get a page, you know, SkyTel two-way pager, right? Another thing that no one has anymore. And it's the guy, the asset I put down in the shooting range saying, he's out of pocket. He's probably coming to you. So apparently, and I've seen the video footage, he goes down there, sends his target downrange, unloads a clip, brings the target back, looks at it, holsters his firearm, turns around and leaves. Doesn't say goodbye to the assistant director or section chief he was shooting with. Nothing. He just realizes, I don't have my Palm Pilot. And this was a device that he kept in his left back pocket and was never parted with, right? Until he sat down, because you couldn't sit on the thing because it's huge. It's not like our little smartphones now. And he's on his way up. And I tell the tech team, you got to get this done, because if he gets back there before me, I'm dead. Like he might shoot me. He's a pretty angry dude at this point. And if this has what we think it might have on it, then I'm in trouble. And I get it. And it's not like James Bond or Jack Bauer. I get there and I've got like a good 2 minutes. I go in the main door to the skiff and shut the door, which saved me. And this is a special compartmentalized intelligence facility. So it's got a combination lock, you've got a badge in, you have to enter a key code. And for reasons that just completely confound me, a regular mechanical key. Like if someone can crack a safe and guess a code and has the security badge. It's like, yeah, they can't pick a lock. Anyway, I shut all that stuff, go over to his desk, kneel down in front of his bag, feeling like I've just won. And I realize I have three devices and there's four pockets and I have no clue at all which I pulled these things out of.
Oh,
I was just so stressed at that moment that my memory recall wasn't working. And I thought to myself in that moment too, I should just put a post-it note, because if he gets here before me, I'm done anyway.
Right.
And as I'm trying to figure out which pocket, I hear him coming through that door. So I just dropped all three, did my best guess, zipped up his pockets, ran back to my desk and sat there and put the best poker face I've ever had.
Oh my gosh.
He comes through the office, so cool, glares at me, goes into his office, slams his door, and I hear zip. And I was thinking at that moment, I was thinking, I am so dead. Like, either he's going to come out here and shoot me, or he's not, and I'm never going to live this down in the FBI.
Like, or I'm going to kill your wife or something.
Now into the future, I'm going to hear about this screw up.
Oh my gosh.
And I had to make a choice. I had to decide whether I was going to get up and leave and head down the hall to an office that had been set up, which was a safe office. There was an armed section chief there who was a friend who was read into the case, and that's where I could go if things got real bad. Or I was going to stay there and make up an excuse, because I knew there's no way I possibly got all three devices in the right place, right? And I did the quick mental math, and I thought about the calculus of this situation. And the fact of the matter was, if I wasn't sitting there when he came out already hyper stressed about the missing his Palm Pilot, going down shooting, not feeling comfortable, he might have cut and run. And we knew that there was a drop coming, and that was when we were going to catch him. If I was sitting there, at least I had a chance to make something up. And so I sat there. I think the other side of it was, I felt like this was my problem to fix, not somebody else's. And by running away from it, I was just leaving it for someone else to clean up. And that wasn't right either. I had to take the good or the bad, whatever was coming to me. So I sat there. He comes out of the office and looks at me. And he leans over my desk and he just looks at me and says, "Were you in my office?" And I said, "Yeah, I put a memo in your inbox. Didn't you see it?" And I had, right? And he just glares at me and he holds it for a long time. And then he says, "I never want you in my office again." And he leaves for the day. Less than a week later, he was in Foxstone Park. He's just made his final drop to the Russians. He starts walking out of the park, gets to his car, and two vans screech to a halt. Panel doors open, FBI agents jump out, point their weapons at him. He raises his hands, drops his keys. He says the guns are not necessary. And then he says, "What took you so long?" And he's arrested. We knew not only where he would be, but when he would be, because a Palm Pilot is a digital calendar. And that's how we caught him doing his final drop. And that is how you catch a spy.
Oh my gosh. That is so crazy.
Good job, man.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What a cool story.
I feel like we just watched the movie.
I know.
And you talked to him after, and y'all, I mean, y'all sat down and went through like, "Hey man, was there any times where..."
You know, I've never spoken to him since. As I was writing Gray Day, I tried. I actually asked permission right after the case because I felt I needed that, right, for closure.
Yeah.
The FBI thought about it, but then declined because they said that we're still trying to get him to plead guilty. And we're afraid that if he learns that you were the person who betrayed him, that he's going to just lawyer up and not work with us. And we really need him to plead guilty. And then I tried to find a way in to see him. He's in Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. It's buried so deep, I couldn't even find a way to get there.
Yeah.
And when I was writing my book, I wanted the last chapter to be a conversation with Hanson.
Yeah.
So.
Well, man, how can... Thank you again for doing this. How can people follow you and find you? And what do you got coming up?
Yeah. So if you want to learn more about the case and more about the evolution of espionage, then grab my book, Gray Day. It's available wherever books are sold or in Kindle. Or if you've sat here for an hour and you really seem to like my voice, then I do the Audible for it because I wrote it from a first person perspective. If you want to ask me a question, you can find me on Twitter at EONEILL, just my first letter of my first name and my last name. And then go to www.ericoneil.net if you want to learn more about my public speaking and other things that I throw on there.
That is is so cool. Thank you for coming on and telling brother. Us your
Hey, man.
Story.
Great story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This was a lot of fun, you know.
And, great history, great family, to meet man. You too. Yeah, tell your family. I want to put this part in there, man. That was one of my favorite things to hear about because I know the nostalgia in those families. Great job, bro, and carrying the line and serving your country.
Yeah, we love generational military families or public service.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's important to serve. I think, you know, we're not here just to find a job and work a career and make money and raise a family. I think that we owe, you know, if we're blessed to have things, we should give them back too.
Oh, yeah, and, sure.
Yeah. We're the only country that doesn't have some sort of mandatory service, right?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being a Catholic.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marcus.
Feel like I'm serving a lot there, too.
Marcus was just
And
confirmed.
This part of it, man, that's the most we do. It's like the first 40, man, it was the academy. Like we just had to sit there and figure out what we weren't or what the training was for and then switch it around and come at it from this angle. It's a lot more peaceful.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, man, it sure is a lot better. Not that the last part wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, when guys like us say that, they're like, oh, well, you wouldn't want. I was like, no, I didn't say that. I wanted to do it, you know, but this part is more joyful.
That's true. You know, my wife's funny. She, when I talk about my, you know, my time in the FBI working undercover, it all is cool, right?
Yeah.
It's only the best stories.
Yeah.
That's right.
And she laughs at me and she says, you know, you used to bitch and complain about how bored you were for in a whole 8 hours. Because sometimes you'd have an 8 hour shift where you'd sit in one spot and you'd stare at like this terrible view of the edge of a tail light.
Yeah.
Just hoping that thing lit up and the person drove away. Mm-hmm. Right. So you could do something. In 8 hours, the guy didn't move. He never came out of his house.
Right.
You know?
And that happens all the time.
All the time.
That's the hint I come at. Yeah, it's like that.
We'd say you'd work 10 hours for 15 minutes of go time. And it was that 15 minutes of go time that we ended up becoming adrenaline addicted to.
That's right. Yeah.
One of Marcus's really close friends went to West Point. I'm not going to say his name, but he went to West Point and then went. He was an Army Ranger, right? Crosses over, goes to Buds, becomes a SEAL. And now he's in the FBI. And I'm like,
how about
you
that? That's a heck of a
career.
But
he's still in, so I can't wait.
You'd
can't
love this guy.
Who he is. But
great dude. I mean, it's kind of like when we look at you, you look like you are what you say, what you do. He's the same way. When you seem like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
You're like, okay. Yeah, he's just very professional and looking and
hair's always
perfect,
manicured, teeth smile, breath always smells like NyQuil.